This is the current federal tax developments for the week of September the 17th, 2018. This week's developments are brought to you by Kaplan Professional Education, Accounting Continuing Education, and by your State Society of CPAs. This week, we're going to look at a few things. First, we want to catch up on where we are now with South Dakota's attempt to actually get a benefit from the Wayfair decision, which is something I'm sure the state looks to benefit from. We're also going to be talking about Colorado, who this week is going to test the limits of how far you can take Wayfair, because the state of Colorado is going to attempt to bring their sales tax system online. And while it's not clear, it's possible they may drag along 349 localities, all with home rule. Those home rule localities will all have their own, or can have their own, special sales tax rules. So that'll be interesting. We're going to talk about a case that, even though the court was a little concerned with the quality of the taxpayer's records, they still allowed that she was a real estate professional. We're going to tell you that the Opportunity Zone regulations, the first set of those, are now at the Office of Management and Budget for their review. So we're hopeful to see regulations on that by the end of the month. And finally, we're going to talk about a dispute that's currently going on that involves the TIGTA, Taxpayer Inspector General's Office for Tax Administration, the IRS, and the Taxpayers Advocates Office over the question of the use of math error procedures when a refund has already been issued. So we have a little mess going on there. Well, let's start this week talking about the state of South Dakota, which is kind of where we ended up a week ago. You may remember last week we told you that South Dakota was going to call a special session of the legislature to deal with two revenue bills, one of which would simply, you know, impose the remote seller rules that they had imposed upon Wayfair, Newegg, and I cannot remember the third defendant in the case. But those three large organizations are going to impose those on all companies now, because they can't yet do it for those three. They're still waiting for the litigation to finish up there. And also put a marketplace rule in, which would be a second revenue bill. On September 13th, those bills were passed and signed into law. So South Dakota now has, in fact, passed these rules. They're by the South Dakota legislature. They've been signed into law by the governor. So we have this rule in place. These take effect effectively November 1st for registration. November 30 is when the collection rules start being enforced. So basically you have November 1st, they'll start signing up people to get their licenses for the remote seller rules. And then at the end of the month, you got to start collecting the tax. So, you know, have a little fun there in South Dakota. You're going to be doing some more work in that area. Okay. So it will be an issue. Again, not unexpected. You know, governors in most states are not going to call special sessions unless they're very sure it's going to pass. These laws passed overwhelmingly through the legislature. In fact, nearly unanimously, as they're called, in one chamber and nearly unanimously in the other. There was some concern expressed about the second one for the marketplace because it had not been part of Wayfair. And some people thought that maybe that was going a little too far. But the vast majority of legislatures at least felt that, no, that wasn't a problem, because a whole bunch of other states have the marketplace rules. And they're probably correct that if it's okay to do the collection for the funds that are coming from the non-marketplace sellers, you know, the individual sellers, the marketplace rules probably work too, to force eBay and Amazon to make those collections on behalf of sellers that are selling through their sites. Now, that one's not really surprising, and we're pretty sure, 99.99% sure, that that is enforceable, and that one is, you know, going to have to be followed by the states, at least unless Congress steps in. Now, a couple of issues I should mention too before I go to the next point. Congress, this week, there was a bill introduced by members of bipartisan sponsors that would seek to limit the state's abilities in this area. Now, again, it may sound good it was bipartisan, but we find out on the sales tax issue that it's not so much a concern whether one's a Democrat or Republican. It happens to do with which state somebody comes from as opposed to which party they come from. That's a little unusual for Washington, but it is. So I'm still not sure. Well, I'm sure it's going to get a hearing in the House Judiciary Committee, because the chair there does not like these concepts of states imposing this. I'm not so sure it's going to get anywhere else. So we'll just have to see how it goes. But nevertheless, you probably will hear about that bill as well. Let's talk about what Colorado did. And this, if anything's going to give impetus to the bill, it's going to be this. The state of Colorado has implemented regulations 39-26102 1.3 and 3626-1029, emergency regulations implemented on September the 12th. And what they're going to do is going to require collections that begin here at the end of the month. And South Dakota was 11-1 collection, I think at 11:30. Colorado's one was 11:30. Now, the good news is they are going to follow South Dakota's de minimis rule. So if you sell into the state of Colorado, you have more than 100,000 of sales or more than 200 individual sales, you have to start collecting and paying over Colorado sales tax. As well, the law makes it clear that once you're subject to that, the Colorado tattletale law that we talked about a long time ago, you know, that basically kind of set up the Wayfair case and got us to the Supreme Court, and Neil Gorsuch got to comment yet again on the topic. You know, he was involved in both the 10th Circuit decision in the case involving the tattletale rule and the Supreme Court decision that overturned Quill eventually. So we've already talked about that. You will be exempted from that if you come here. But the big issue is Colorado is not a member of the Streamlined Sales and Use Tax Agreement. They're not an SSUTA state. And a primary reason why they're not is they are, for sales tax, what's called a home rule state. That is, the state of Colorado allows every locality, should they wish to do so, to basically set up their own sales tax collection systems and collect their own sales tax. 349 jurisdictions in the state of Colorado have taken the state up on that offer. So in addition to filing a sales tax return with the state, you may have 349 other tax returns to file if you sell into all the jurisdictions in the state of Colorado. And what's not clear from this reg is whether triggering Colorado filing automatically triggers filing in all those 349 separate jurisdictions, assuming you have any sales into any of them. That is utterly not clear. We were actually, the reporting on this in Tax Analysts and Tax Notes indicated that many of the municipalities were surprised out of the blue this came out. So they're not sure how they're going to react to this. The Colorado Department of Revenue has not really said whether this really means that the localities can all go on their own. And the problem right now is we're going to start doing this on 11:30. And for the moment, you pretty much have to assume that, you know, the localities might say that, well, once you're in Colorado, you got one sale with us, you can file with us. So this could get very messy with the 349 jurisdictions. A real concern, and basically the Tax Foundation had articles on this that we reference in our write-up, and their concern, which I would share, is this may be pushing a bit far if all 349 jurisdictions get to force you to file, and they get to do so as soon as you trigger any filing requirements in the state of Colorado, whether this would not be considered an unconstitutional restraint on trade due to the logic that Justice Kennedy gave us that allowed for Wayfair. Remember, Justice Kennedy specifically said, you know, in essence, there are these other ways you could be stopped. However, he really liked the fact that South Dakota was a streamlined sales and use tax state. Colorado is not. He really liked the fact there was no retroactivity. Colorado kind of doesn't tell us there. And finally, you know, that there was a very simplified system for applying for getting in and paying the tax. 349 jurisdictions plus the state is hardly simplified. So now we got a problem as we would fully expect a challenge to be raised against this system. And this at least seems to have a reasonable chance of prevailing, at least unless Colorado gets some system put together this year through probably legislation that would basically shut down the home rule operation, at least for remote sellers, and impose a general sales tax collection mechanism that would apply for remote sellers as opposed to having to comply with 349 separate sales tax codes potentially. But anyway, we'll see. This is the first state to really push and give us a wildly complex. Now, other states have this sort of problem. Arizona's not quite as bad as Colorado, but Arizona's still interesting. You know, in essence, Arizona does allow cities to select certain changes from the sales tax code, which can complicate matters. So we'll have to see whether, you know, What does this do if Colorado gets away with it? Do other states just say, yep, you got to comply with all of our local rules, even though we allow home rules, so the state doesn't basically assign it? Some states say that you have to follow our sales tax, what's taxable, what's not. You guys just get to set the rate. But that's not the case here. And that's a much more complex and a much messier system. Well, let's go on now to a federal case from the tax court. And this is a case of Birdsong versus Commissioner. Tax Court Memorandum Decision 2008-148 came down on September the 10th. This case involves a question of whether a taxpayer was a real estate professional. In this case, it's a married couple. The wife solely worked on the rentals. The husband was an MD, so he was not involved in any way, shape, or form with the rentals. However, they did own two separate rentals. They were multi-unit properties. So, they were small, let's say a very small apartment complexes. Each had less than 10 units. So it wasn't, we're not talking about managing a huge apartment building here. We are talking about managing, a number of tenants, a number of issues. So they have these two multi-unit properties. The wife had records of a sort to show what she did on the property. However, she came back later after the exam started. And remember, she had, in essence, the hitch was she only had 844.75 hours on her records. But she went back, found additional records, additional things she had done, and got up to 1,136 and a quarter hours. Okay. So there were items that they had not previously treated as being subject to the tax, part of what she was doing that they picked up. So now suddenly we got over our limit. We're over the 850 requirement. And we all agree that she didn't do anything else. So that wasn't our problem. We didn't have a problem that she did other things. So our only issue was, did she violate the rules by not having enough hours? And the problem is, she had to come up with these revisions to her records. These revisions came in after the fact. In certain prior cases, tax court very much has made clear, we cannot use, rough guesses and records where you just from memory try to reconstruct everything after the fact. The tax court has frowned upon that structure. The IRS says, well, look at this. She's short. And, we had the 70 hours. She's got this 844. It's not necessarily short, but it's not really far over. And, of course, we're going to challenge some of those, we'll say. So, we don't think these extra hours count. The fact she added them means that these records were not contemporaneous. And because of that, we don't think that she met the test to be a real estate professional. Because everybody agreed, the real issue was, did she have enough hours and did she have the documentation for those hours? In this case, the tax court found her believable. By the way, that's probably the one most important thing in this case. And it's something to make very clear to your clients. This person was credible. Credibility is easily lost. If the client had been found, let's say the taxpayer had been found on exam, to have lied about something or to basically try to pull a fast one, any of those things would be introduced by the IRS and would come to the court's attention and would tend to undermine her credibility, because at this point, the court is being asked to believe her statements. And that's in many ways the only evidence they've got, especially for these final additional hours that gave her a bit of breathing room. But the court found her credible. Now, what that means is that we don't know for sure, but I think it's safe to assume that when the IRS examined this return, they didn't suddenly discover that, oh, by the way, they had tried to sneak through something, let's say as a medical expense, a bill paid to a veterinarian, that they can be expensive. So, pet caring for pets can be expensive and that can be costly, but they didn't catch things like that could be used to undermine credibility. The records that she had, everything tied in, you could back them up, to other documents. If you went and looked, none of her dates had days when it appeared that she worked more than 24 hours in a day. That also kills your credibility. None of this stuff looked manufactured. So the court bought it. Now, the court warned her that really your records need to be better than this. You can't just go along with this type of records. But the court said, despite that, we're going to go ahead and say, in this case, we believe you are a real estate professional. Next issue up. Some of you, I know a lot of people have talked to me about opportunity zones, and we've had a lot of questions and discussions about them, you know, interest in them. Some people want to know more about them. And the hitch is that the problem is we passed this bill back in December. But as of today, we do know what the opportunity zones are. The IRS published that list. But we don't have any regulations yet that really tell us how to work with this. Now, the way the qualified opportunity zone funds work is this, and this is the key issue we're looking at today. You're allowed to defer gains from the sale of property held by the taxpayer sold to a third party as long as you reinvest that gain in a qualified opportunity zone within 180 days. That's found in Internal Revenue Code section 1400 cap Z-2. And that deferred gain, you know, is income on the earlier the date the fund is sold or December 31st, 2026. However, this deferred gain can actually be gotten rid of. If the investment is held over 5 years, the basis in deferred gain, which starts out at zero, is increased to 10% deferred gain. If the taxpayer holds the property more than 7 years, the excluded gain increases by an additional 5% of the gain. And if the qualified property is held for at least 10 years, they can have the basis of such property set equal to fair value on the date the investment is sold or exchanged. So if you invest in this property, you take your gains, you invest in this property, if you can hold for 10 years, there's an amazing tax benefit that's given to you. And that's really kind of interesting that we can, you know, that we can go ahead and make a transfer like this, right? So this is kind of interesting, you know, that we could be able to do this sort of thing and get tax-free appreciation out of this thing too. So a lot of people are interested in this. Well, the catch is the regulations now have been reported in RIN 1545-BP03, the Office of Information and Regulatory Affairs, the Office of Management and Budget, on September the 12th noted that they have the regs in for review. Under the agreement between Treasury and the OMB, the Office of Information and Regulatory Affairs has 10 business days to complete their review. That's effectively 2 weeks, right, to complete their review of this. At the end of that time, they may tell the IRS they need to revise this, they may raise other issues, or they may clear them. If they clear them, we could be looking at these regulations coming out, you know, around the end of the month. So we may know, at least, let's say, by early October, how these regs are going to work. If you have clients who have been interested in this, especially clients, you know, who may have property they plan to sell to gain, and they'd like to reinvest in these funds, at least we'll know a lot more about how the mechanics are going to work here, because there's questions about, is it only capital gains or can ordinary gains go into it? You know, various other issues need to be resolved. Now, the OMB was not great on their titles. The title of this claims it relates to gains, opportunity fund gains, right? But there are other mechanical operations here. Now, in the case of the 199 Cap A regs, that just said operational rules. We discovered that was only one of essentially six different regulations that were in the package that OMB approved. So we don't know for sure how broad this package is. For instance, let's change this a little bit. This week, we also got, for any of you interested in this, the regulations under the Global Intangible Low Tax Income Tax, the GILTI tax. And I'm not going to cover that in detail because that applies to a relatively interesting subset, but not a broad application to most people listening to this. Obviously, it applies to you. It really matters to you. Those that understood how that worked and the issue, the actual regs that came out this week are, we've now discovered, only one of three sets are going to come out and don't deal with some of the messier issues or some of the ones that raise some real policy problems. So again, we're not sure if the opportunity zone regs will actually be everything, like the 199 Cap A regs were, everything except for cooperatives were the only thing left out that's going to come later there. Or are these going to be more like the GILTI regs, where we just get a subpart that relates to this reinvested gain, but not really other operational issues regarding these funds? We'll just have to wait and see. Finally, we have a nice little battle going on here between the IRS and the Taxpayers Advocate's Office that was triggered by a TIGTA report, okay? And this is Program Manager Technical Advice 2018-017. It was issued on September the 7th. And what this deals with, you may remember, the PATH Act. Remember that one that we passed at the end of 2015? It basically added some requirements for people applying for the Earned Income Credit, the Child Tax Credit, the Additional Child Tax Credit, and the American Opportunities Tax Credit. For any returns filed after the effective date of PATH, which was December 18, 2015, that they had to provide those numbers. Well, TIGTA found that the IRS hadn't really ramped this system up quickly and found a number of returns that, you know, failed this test or appeared to fail this test. These people did not have their ID numbers in time to be able to request this particular benefit, and the IRS didn't do the checking to make sure that that was the case. So the problem is the IRS then was told, you know, this is it. You got to respond to TIGTA and say, okay, how are you going to fix this problem? The IRS responded indicating that, well, you know, they thought one way they could do it would be to use the math error corrections. Now, math error corrections are an interesting part of the code. The math error corrections are found in section 6213B1. And what that allows the IRS to do, if there's a mathematical clerical error, and there's a long list of things, it's 6213G2, there is a very long, it's got an extremely long list of things that are called mathematical errors. And it's not simply things you might think are mathematical. It would include things like authority to make a math change when somebody didn't have the ID number in time. That's not really a math error, but, you know, in the way you might think of a math error, but it's been defined by Congress as one. That they can use that. The advantage of the math error routines is this. The IRS goes straight to assessment. Well, they do so essentially unless the taxpayer within 60 days sends a notice back, right, to the IRS saying, you know, no, I demand you abate this, okay? And if you do that within 60 days, the IRS has to do it. And then the IRS has to use the regular assessment rules under 6501, which will give you the right to formally dispute things, you know, and file in tax court if need be before having to pay the tax. But if you fail to respond within 60 days, then the tax goes straight to assessment. You have to pay the tax, etc. Some problems with this is obviously with math errors. First thing is the IRS sends out fewer notices for math errors because there are fewer steps. And then number two with math errors, you know, once we get to that 60 days, you have very few options. And finally, as the taxpayer advocate noted, you know, a lot of taxpayers don't end up getting this notice. And, you know, and because there's only like the one notice that comes quickly and then suddenly we're at assessment, taxpayers are behind the eight ball. And the taxpayer advocate specifically noted that especially people who are lower income tend to move more often. Therefore, they tend not to get there. Therefore, the mail may not catch up with them. Therefore, they may find they have an assessment before they realize anything's happening. Okay, all those issues. The taxpayer advocate said you should not be able to use this authority after the fact. In essence, once you process the return, that should close off the ability to use math errors. Well, the program manager technical advice ruled that that's not the case. They said, here's your problem. The law does not impose any time limits on using math errors as long as the tax is still available for assessment. They're saying also some of these errors can't really be noticed at the time the return is filed. So, you know, what Congress has added is errors that could not be noticed, you know, until later. So they say, look, the IRS has full authority to go back and do this. Now, what was really funny was later in the week, the National Taxpayer Advocate on her blog wrote a long discussion where she questioned whether this is constitutional if the IRS moves forward on this. Now, the program manager technical advice said there are reasons why the service might not want to do this, and nothing requires the service to use the math error procedures in this area. In essence, they're saying, IRS, you know, go figure this out. But certainly the taxpayer advocate appears to be upset about this, and it could be interesting to see how this finally resolves if the service really does move forward. And to solve the problem TIGTA came up with, goes ahead and issues these math error notices, or whether they issue them and then, you know, at some point the challenge is mounted based on the taxpayer's advocate's arguments for being it unconstitutional. Interesting thought, though. You've basically got three parts of Treasury who are kind of going at each other in the midst of all this. as we remind you, yeah, I know we're in deadline days and you guys, yeah, hey, this is the 17th is the day this is scheduled to come out on in a lot of the states. And of course, that day, you're probably not going to be listening to anything because you're finishing up your final partnerships and S corporations. And then you move straight onto your trust. But remember, after the dust settles from all that, be sure to take a look at your state CPA society courses. They're available. Now, some of us have fewer trusts. So I'm actually going to be doing a pair of courses in South Dakota, one of which is on cybersecurity for CPAs, one of which is best practices. It'll be at their annual convention, and it'll be in Pierre. So if you're going there, you go ahead and sign up for that, and I'll be going there for that. But I really start moving on doing courses once we get past the end of October 15th. We start doing some real courses as we enter into the end of October and beginning of November. So be a sure check there. By the way, we've got courses coming up in both Arizona and Idaho. I've got courses where I'm going to be teaching about the 199 Cap A rules and other TCJA business issues. I'm also going to be doing an update on the Wayfair issues and other multi-state taxations issues in Idaho in the month of October. So make sure you're aware of that. Be coming up, I'll be speaking at the Oregon's Tax Conference that'll be up there in Portland early in November. I'll be speaking at Arizona's conference as well early in November. So we're going to have a couple of conference things going up. Also be doing conferences in Minnesota. And then be doing the regular old run-of-the-mill courses coming up. You know, tax updates in Tucson and Phoenix. I'll be doing some courses. I'm scheduled to do courses in Ohio. It's going to be an interesting time. Be sure to check your state CPA society, though, and sign up for these CPE courses, especially the live courses, where you can actually interact with other people in the room, not just the instructor, but other CPAs. This has been Current Federal Tax Developments for the week of September the 17th. Be sure to check for regular updates on our website, currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. If you have any questions or comments, send them to me, edzollers@currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. You can follow me on Twitter. On Twitter, I'm at edzollers. And you can also follow me on the subreddit at reddit.com/r/taxpros. I also do monitor three state society discussion groups in California, Arizona, and New Jersey. So if you have access to those, you can go ahead and post questions there. We've had interesting discussions on all of them about different issues. Currently talking about S-Corp debt repayment on the California discussion group. So we had a nice long discussion about that there. We've been discussing 199 Cap A as continues to be a problem everywhere. So if you have access to those, and by the way, if you have access to any state society's discussion group, take a look in there. You'll probably find some useful, some people giving useful answers and some useful tools. Well, we look forward to seeing you next week. I'm going to be on the road this week, so I will be flying back in on Friday night. I speak at the Phoenix Tax Workshop on Saturday morning, so I probably won't get this recorded until much later next week. It'll still be out by Monday because I have to get on my way to Pierre. I got to start my trip to Pierre on Monday because I have to fly into Sioux Falls and then drive over. So it's going to take a little while to get to Pierre. But I will have it posted by the end of the weekend. But be sure to check there. And we'll look forward. We'll try to keep up what's happening this week. And we look forward to giving you updates on current federal tax developments for the week coming so that you can keep yourself up to date.